Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 111.
When a rigidly structured aristocratic system suffers a catastrophic collapse.
And we mean a collapse from the inside out and the outside in simultaneously. It is just, it's wild.
It is. So for anyone listening who might not be, you know, intimately familiar with the source material, can you give us a quick rundown?
Sure. Dream of the Red Chamber is essentially the crown jewel of Chinese literature.
Right.
It was written in the 18th century during the Qing Dynasty, and it's this massive, sprawling epic that tracks the rise and the precipitous fall of the Jia family.
And we are diving into a very specific late chapter here.
Exactly. This is the point where all the chickens are finally coming home to roost.
Yeah, it's such a brilliant text for examining systemic failure, because the author doesn't just show you the cracks in the foundation.
No, he shows you the termites, the rot, and like the hurricane hitting all at the exact same moment.
Yeah, all at once. And to set the stage for you, the listener, you really have to picture the scale of what we are dealing with here.
Right. The Jia family compound isn't just a big house. It is practically a city within a city.
Hundreds of servants, multiple generations of masters, internal economies, dedicated security forces.
A massive, rigid hierarchy.
Yeah.
But right now, the beloved matriarch, Jia Mu, she's dead.
And she was really the emotional and political center of gravity for this entire compound, so the whole place is in mourning.
But beneath the surface of the rituals and the incense and the tears, there is just absolute chaos.
Absolute chaos. We're talking supernatural visitations, intense philosophical debates about human existence.
And a very real, looming physical threat that absolutely no one seems prepared to handle.
Right, no one. What really stands out when you analyze this specific sequence of events is how the narrative just aggressively weaves different genres together.
Oh, it really does. You have this metaphysical ghost story sitting right next to a gritty, street-level true crime narrative.
Yeah, and the author uses these contrasting elements to dissect a single unifying theme, right?
Exactly. The sheer fragility of centralized power. When you remove the main pillar of a massive institution, the structural damage is secondary.
Secondary to what?
To the human nature that is suddenly laid bare. It just gets so messy.
It does get messy. So, okay, let's unpack this from the very beginning of the collapse. Because the institutional collapse starts with a deeply physical one.
Right. Let's look at the household manager, Xifeng.
Yeah, Xifeng. In the ecosystem of the Jia family, she is essentially the CEO.
She is the linchpin of the estate's daily operations, and she is at her absolute breaking point here.
She really is. She has this terrifying moment where she is so overcome by anger, grief, and sheer exhaustion.
That she literally spits blood and faints right there on the ground.
Spits blood. I mean, it's a visceral, deeply unsettling image. Xifeng isn't just experiencing normal fatigue here.
No, not at all. The text is showing us a body physically rejecting the immense, unnatural burden of holding a performative reality together.
Because the emotional labor of managing the funeral of a matriarch in this society is just immense, right?
It's lethal. She is coordinating the guests, the rituals, the financial outflow, while also managing the internal politics. It's too much.
Way too much. And her loyal maid, Pinger, is desperately trying to manage the immediate fallout of this.
Right. She catches Xifeng, gets her into bed, and immediately sends word to the elders of the family.
Specifically to Lady Xing and Lady Wang. The message is basically, hey, the manager is down. She is vomiting blood. We have a crisis.
And the reaction from Lady Xing is incredibly revealing.
Okay, yes. Help me understand this, because she doesn't entirely believe it, does she?
No, she assumes Xifeng is just faking it to dodge her responsibilities because the funeral is so chaotic.
Wait, she thinks she's faking a literal hemorrhage? Is Lady Xing just incredibly callous, or is this a symptom of a system where trust has just completely evaporated?
I wouldn't call it mere disbelief. It's a deeply ingrained cynicism. You really have to understand the corporate culture of the Jia estate.
Corporate culture, yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Lady Xing's reaction exposes an environment that is entirely transactional and just saturated with suspicion.
Because in this household, people constantly maneuver for advantage.
Exactly. Sickness, grief, familial duty, these aren't just human experiences to them. They are tactical tools.
Wow. So they are routinely weaponized to avoid unpleasant tasks or to garner sympathy.
Precisely.
So, to put it in modern terms, it's like the CEO of a massive failing corporation having a medically documented heart attack in the middle of a board meeting.
And the board of directors just rolls their eyes.
Right. They assume she's staging it to avoid answering questions about the plummeting stock price.
That is a very apt parallel. When you operate in a system where everyone is assumed to be running an angle, genuine vulnerability just becomes illegible.
Illegible, so. That's so true. When Xifeng actually hits a biological wall, the default assumption from upper management is that it's a strategic maneuver.
Because empathy is entirely absent. It doesn't serve a political purpose in their internal hierarchy.
Empathy doesn't serve a purpose. I mean, that is a chilling way to run a family.
It is, and it has immediate operational consequences.
Yeah.
Because Xifeng is genuinely incapacitated, the entire household immediately goes topsy-turvy.
Topsy-turvy, that's the translation, right? It implies a total, almost comedic upending of order.
Yeah, the second the maids, the lower-level managers, and the servants realize there is no immediate oversight, the discipline dissolves.
It's like the eye of Sauron is temporarily closed.
Exactly. People start slacking off, sneaking away to take naps. The noise levels in the usually quiet corridors rise.
It really reveals a terrifying truth about the Jia family's power.
Which is that the order of the house wasn't based on mutual respect, shared values, or institutional loyalty.
Right. It was based entirely on the fear of Xifeng's ruthless authority.
Centralized power is fragile.
It really is. If your entire system only functions because one single person is terrifyingly competent and punitive,
you don't actually have a functional system. You have a hostage situation.
A hostage situation. Yeah. Yes. And when the hostage taker goes down, the hostages don't maintain the schedule. They rebel.
Exactly. So the men of the family, Jia Lin and Jia Zeng, are suddenly faced with this logistical nightmare.
Because they realize Xifeng is genuinely too sick to attend the massive public funeral procession for the matriarch.
And the funeral absolutely cannot stop. The optics are just too important to them.
So what do they decide to do? They decide to leave Xifeng, along with a young, somewhat detached girl named Xu Jun, behind to watch the house.
And this decision is the fatal flaw. It is the hinge upon which the entire disaster swings.
I was reading this and practically yelling at the page. I mean, it seems like a massive, inexcusable oversight.
It absolutely is.
They are leaving a sprawling compound which houses the matriarch's suite, essentially a vault containing gold and silver.
And heirlooms.
And the people they leave in charge are an incapacitated woman coughing up blood and a young girl with absolutely no real authority.
Or worldly experience, right?
How does anyone justify that from a security standpoint?
Well, you have to look at it through the lens of their specific patriarchal worldview.
Okay, unpack that for me.
For men like Jia Zeng and Jia Lian, their primary concern is the external performance of status.
So the public display of grief, the sheer size of the funeral procession, the strict adherence to social protocol.
Exactly. That is what maintains their political capital in the eyes of the emperor and society.
Oh, I see. So the actual practical reality of securing their physical assets is treated as secondary.
Almost beneath them, really.
It's sheer hubris. They assume the walls of the estate are enough.
It goes deeper than hubris, actually. They genuinely believe that the social standing of the Jia name is an invisible force field.
Wow. So they assume their status just makes them untouchable.
Right. To even acknowledge the need for heavy, practical security would be to admit that they are vulnerable.
Which contradicts the illusion of absolute aristocratic power they are trying to project with this grand funeral.
Precisely. Everyone is so busy performing for the public that the actual gears of the machine are grinding to a halt behind the scenes.
And that brings us to a shift in the narrative that I found, honestly, profoundly moving. And philosophically dense.
It's a crucial pivot. The story moves from this macro-level household breakdown to the deeply intimate internal tragedy of a maid named Yuan Yang.
Yeah, the author pulls us away from the grand logistics and forces us to look at the collateral damage.
Yuan Yang's internal monologue here is just devastating.
It really is. And for context for the listener, Yuan Yang was the deceased matriarch's most trusted, high-ranking maid.
Right. While the matriarch was alive, Yuan Yang wielded immense proxy power.
She held the keys. She managed the matriarch's personal wealth.
But with the matriarch dead, Yuan Yang is running a terrifying calculus in her head.
Because she realizes her umbrella of protection has just completely vanished.
She is a textbook example of borrowed authority.
Borrowed authority. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, she possessed immense power to direct others, but zero structural power over her own life.
So her identity, her safety, her entire value in that ecosystem were derived exclusively from the person she served.
Exactly. Once that person is gone, the system instantly reclassifies her from a manager back to property.
That is so dark. And she knows exactly what the system has planned for her, doesn't she?
Oh, she knows. She knows she will either be claimed and abused by the lecherous elder master, Jia Shi,
who has aggressively preyed on her in the past.
Right. Or She will be forcibly married off to some lowly servant as a way to discard her and remove her from the inner circle.
She is completely trapped.
Her vulnerability is absolute. In the legal and social framework of the time, she has no recourse.
She can't just quit and walk out the front gate.
No, she is bound to the estate.
So she makes a definitive choice. She decides that the only clean escape from a system that is about to devour her is death.
It's her only way out. She walks back to the matriarch's dimly lit, now empty suite, intending to hang herself.
And this is where the text takes a hard, sudden left turn into the supernatural.
It really does. The spatial dynamics of this scene are incredibly evocative.
Just as she is preparing to go through with it, the atmosphere shifts and she sees a ghost.
Specifically, the ghost of Kin Keeking, another woman from the family.
Yeah, it's a dimly lit room. Shadows are playing tricks. The air is thick with recent death.
The profound sense of isolation is palpable. It sets the perfect stage for a metaphysical intervention.
And what's wild is that it's not just a traditional ghost story where the spirit appears to terrorize the living.
No, it's almost administrative.
Administrative. Yes, it feels like the most surreal, metaphysical job recruitment imaginable.
That is the perfect word for it. The bureaucracy of the mortal world is mirrored in the spiritual world.
The ghost, Keeking, explains that she isn't just a wandering spirit trapped by trauma.
Right, she is actually acting as the sister of a fairy named Disenchantment.
And Keeking has been officially sent from the illusion realm, this higher spiritual plane, to bring Yuanyang over to the other side.
And her specific purpose is fascinating.
To recruit Yuanyang to manage something called the Department of Foolish Passion.
Which forces us to reconsider the entire philosophical framework of the text.
Let's dig into that, because when I read this, my immediate reaction was just massive confusion. There seems to be a glaring contradiction.
What did you find contradictory?
Well, Yuanyang literally argues with the ghost. She says, I am the most heartless person in this entire compound.
Right.
She says she has spent her life being pragmatic, dutiful, and actively rejecting any romantic or sexual entanglements.
Yes.
So how can she possibly be considered someone with passion? Why is the most emotionally disciplined woman being recruited for a department of passion?
That tension is exactly what the author wants you to wrestle with. Keeking addresses this directly in the text.
Okay, how does she explain it?
Keeking explains that the mortal world has a fundamentally corrupted understanding of the word passion, or king, in the original context.
Corrupted how? Because when we hear passion, we think of affairs, burning bridges, dramatic behavior.
Exactly. Society equates passion with physical lust, with messy romantic entanglements, the chaotic worldly desires that lead to scandal.
But Keeking offers a radically different definition.
She argues that true king, true emotion and passion, is human nature before it is expressed.
She uses a brilliant analogy, right? The unbloomed flower.
Yes, she compares it to an unbloomed flower. Once the flower blooms, once the emotion is acted upon and brought into the messy physical world, it loses its purity.
Wow. So it becomes tainted by transaction, by selfish desire, by the muddy reality of human interaction.
The very act of expressing the passion degrades it.
This is wild. So the text is arguing that by never engaging in those worldly entanglements, Yuanyang actually possesses the purest form of passion.
That is exactly the argument. By remaining completely heartless and stoic in the eyes of society, her passion remains pristine.
Because it remains entirely internal, unspent, and uncompromised by the world.
It is the pure potential of human feeling. Mm-hmm. And this completely reframes her suicide.
It really does. It is not framed merely as an act of desperate escape from G. She's predation, though it certainly is that on a literal level.
But on a metaphysical level, it is a profound assertion of bodily and spiritual autonomy.
Right. By choosing to end her life, she preserves that unbloomed flower.
She refuses to let her essence be dragged into the mud of forced marriage or sexual abuse.
She elevates herself out of the corrupt living world and secures a position of genuine, unassailable spiritual authority.
It's incredibly heavy. It takes an act that modern readers often view through the lens of utter defeat or tragedy and recasts it.
It recasts it as the ultimate act of defiance within the logic of this specific universe.
She reclaims her agency in the only way the system allows.
But then, the moment she actually goes through with it, the narrative snaps us violently back to the brutal reality of the physical world.
It does. Her body is discovered by two other maids, Amber and Pearl.
And the household, which was already barely functioning, just erupts into absolute panic.
The whiplash there is very intentional.
I felt the whiplash. The author wants you to feel that jarring contrast, doesn't he?
Absolutely. The contrast between the elevated, pristine spiritual realm Yuanyang has just entered and the chaotic, messy, grounded reality of the people left dealing with her body.
It is so jarring. And what I found fascinating is how wildly different the reactions to her death are.
The way people respond to a suicide in this book tells you everything you need to know about their character.
And the culture they live in. Let's look at Bayou first. He's the young male protagonist of the family.
Right, known for being incredibly sensitive.
He hears the news and his initial reaction is what you'd expect. He cries hysterically.
But then, almost immediately, he completely pivots.
Yes, he stops crying and starts rejoicing. He actually becomes visibly happy.
Because he realizes Yuanyang found her proper spiritual end.
Okay, from the outside looking in, and certainly to a modern listener, laughing or rejoicing at a young woman's suicide seems deeply inappropriate.
It looks entirely unhinged to most people.
How do we make sense of this immediate pivot from grief to joy without just assuming Baoyu has lost his mind?
Well, to many of the characters in the text, it does look unhinged. They frequently assume Baoyu is mentally unstable.
Right.
But his reaction follows a very strict internal logic based on his philosophy of gender and spirituality.
His philosophy of gender, right? Explain that to us.
Baoyu fundamentally believes that the pure, uncorrupted spiritual energy of the universe resides exclusively in young women.
He has this famous quote, right, where he calls men muddy.
Yes, he calls men turbid things or muddy creatures made of dirt, whereas he says women are made of pure water.
So in his view, men are inherently corrupted by the systems they create. Politics, greed, lust, the pursuit of status.
Exactly. While women, at least before they are forced into the systems of marriage and power, retain a kind of divine purity.
Men are the polluters. Women are the pristine environment.
So when Baoyu first learns of Yuanyang's death, the human part of him is struck by the loss, so he cries.
But then his philosophical framework asserts itself.
Right. He recognizes exactly what we just discussed regarding the unbloomed flower.
He realizes that she has successfully escaped the mud. She has permanently avoided being tainted by men like his uncle.
In Baiyu's mind, she hasn't lost her life. She has achieved a profound spiritual victory.
She has returned to the pure source of the universe. That is why he rejoices.
And it's incredibly telling that Bochai, his wife, who is usually very pragmatic, is the only one who quietly understands his reaction.
She knows it looks crazy to the rest of the household, but she understands the philosophical leap he just made.
Bochai acts as the bridge here. She grounds Baoyu's high-minded mysticism in the reality of their social dynamics.
So you have this very high spiritual mourning happening with Baoyu. He is engaging with the metaphysical tragedy of the event.
But meanwhile, the adult men who actually run the estate are dealing with the fallout in a completely different way.
Right, the men responsible for the logistics. Jia Zheng, who is acting as the patriarch in this moment, orders a grand burial for Yuanyang.
He treats her with an unusual level of respect, framing her as someone who was martyred out of loyalty to the matriarch.
But then, the cold, hard, material reality of the estate sets in.
This is where the text is at its most cynical.
It ruthlessly strips away any remaining romanticism about the household, doesn't it?
It forces you to look at the underlying economics.
It is brutal to read. The family calls in Yuanyang's sister-in-law.
And the estate managers give her a payout. 100 taels of silver from the deceased matriarch's personal funds.
This is ostensibly compensation or perhaps a reward for Yuanyang's perceived loyalty.
And the sister-in-law's reaction is just staggering.
She is thrilled. She is practically glowing about the influx of money and the prestige of the grand funeral arrangements.
To give you some context on that sum, 100 taels of silver in the Qing dynasty was a massive amount of money for a commoner.
Like, how massive?
It could easily sustain a working-class family for years or buy substantial property.
Wow. So it is life-changing wealth being handed over in exchange for a corpse.
Exactly. Any performative grief the sister-in-law might have attempted is completely overpowered by the sudden reality of this wealth.
I found myself comparing it to a grim life insurance settlement.
That's a perfect comparison.
But the twisted part is that the beneficiary is the very family that helped drive the person to despair in the first place.
Right. If you remember earlier in the story, Yuanyang's own family, specifically the sister-in-law and her brother, were the ones pressuring her.
They wanted her to submit to the older master's predatory demands because they wanted the social and financial kickbacks.
They absolutely were complicit. They never viewed Yuanyang as a human being with agency.
They viewed her as a highly valuable asset to be leveraged for their own advancement within the household's hierarchy.
And the author doesn't let this hypocrisy slide.
No, he doesn't. He includes a detail that just pierces right through the solemnity of the funeral preparations.
Another servant, standing nearby, watches the sister-in-law rejoicing over the silver and mocks her.
This unnamed servant basically says, look at you. You are thrilled to have basically sold a live girl for 100 pieces of silver.
Just imagine how much more you would have made if you had managed to sell her to the lecherous master.
That line is a gut punch.
It is arguably one of the sharpest, most violently cynical moments in the entire text.
It completely deflates all the elevated philosophy we just discussed.
It cuts through everything. Jiazeng's respectful bows to the coffin, Baoyu's spiritual musings about water and mud.
All of it is undercut by this single venomous comment from a low-level servant who sees exactly what is actually happening.
It forces the reader to look at the raw, unfiltered economics of human life in this system.
The high-minded philosophy is revealed to be a luxury of the elite.
Exactly. For the servant class, people are commodities. A young woman's life has a specific calculable market value.
The mocking servant exposes the ugly unspoken truth. The sister-in-law isn't mourning a lost family member. She is celebrating a return on investment.
The genius of this chapter is how it masterfully contrasts the elevated poetic tragedy of Yuanyang's soul with the ugly transactional reality of her physical body.
Right. So we've just experienced this deeply philosophical, emotional, and frankly, depressing sequence.
About a young woman's suicide and the monetization of her death, yeah.
Think about the emotional state that puts the reader in, and then the narrative violently shifts again.
We get an absolute genre whiplash.
We go from a metaphysical gothic tragedy straight into a gritty street-level crime plot.
It's a brilliant structural move by the author.
It really is. It illustrates a core principle of systemic failure.
Just as the family's internal moral center completely collapses with Yuanyang's death, the external threat materializes.
The vacuum created by the internal decay actively draws in the external predators.
Nature abhors a vacuum, and so does the criminal underworld.
Right, so we are suddenly introduced to a character named He San.
He's a former servant of the Jia family. He was beaten, fired, and is now entirely broke.
We find him spending his days in a shady, low-rent, smoke-filled casino, nursing his grievances.
And while he's sitting there, a fellow gambler starts working him over, manipulating him.
This gambler knows He San used to work for the great untouchable Jia family.
He San is the archetype of the disgruntled insider. He is the ultimate security vulnerability.
Because he knows the architectural layout, he knows the guard schedules.
And most importantly, he knows the psychological weaknesses of the people inside.
It's exactly like the setup of a classic heist movie. You've got the disgruntled ex-employee providing the literal blueprints to an opportunistic crime syndicate.
The gambler points at something incredibly dangerous to He San.
Right. He points out that the Jia family has millions of gold and silver stashed in the deceased matriarch's room.
And because of the massive funeral procession we talked about earlier, that room is currently utterly unguarded.
And the gambler isn't just a random casino patron looking for a quick score either.
No. The text specifically notes that he reveals he has friends from the coast waiting to strike.
He suggests they use He San's insider knowledge to execute a coordinated robbery.
A full-blown inside job.
I have to stop and ask you about the logistics of this because it boggles the mind. They have gold, and they leave it completely unguarded.
It seems insane, doesn't it?
It does. We touched on this earlier with Jialian and Jiazeng's decision to leave the sick manager in charge, but hearing the criminals actually articulate the vulnerability makes it sound even more insane.
Right.
Is this sheer blinding hubris? Did the Jia family genuinely believe their social status made them magical, or are they really just that incompetent?
It's a highly toxic combination of both, actually. You have to remember the historical timeline of this family.
Okay, tell me about that.
For generations, their name alone was a fortress. No one would dare steal from a duke's estate.
Because the social and legal repercussions would be apocalyptic.
Exactly. So, yes, there's massive hubris. They assume the psychological barrier of their status is as strong as a physical wall.
But it's also profound systemic incompetence, isn't it?
Oh, totally. The people who actually manage the practical physical security, the capable guards, the sharp-eyed managers.
They have either been alienated, fired, or shifeng, are physically collapsing.
The family is running entirely on the fumes of their past reputation.
And the criminals in the casino can smell that the tank is empty.
Exactly.
Hee-san represents the direct consequences of the family's harsh, arbitrary management style coming back to haunt them.
They fired him violently, likely without severance or a safety net.
Without ever considering that throwing a desperate man who knows all your secrets out onto the street might pose a security risk.
It's class resentment weaponized against extreme privilege.
Spot on.
And what about these friends from the coast? That specific phrase stuck out to me. It sounds like a euphemism for organized crime.
It's actually a very significant historical and political detail for the era.
Really? What does it mean?
Friends from the coast is a coded reference to roving bandits, pirates, or organized rebel groups.
Wow, so it signifies that larger societal instability is brewing.
Yes. The macro-level chaos of the empire, the lawlessness, banditry that usually stays on the fringes of society or the frontiers.
It is no longer staying on the fringes.
The state's control is slipping, and that instability is bleeding directly into the capital.
And specifically, into the once impenetrable private sphere of the aristocratic elite.
The walls aren't just metaphorically coming down. They are about to be literally breached by the chaos of the outside world.
Which brings us to the night of the actual intrusion. And the text sets this up with the most incredible cinematic contrast.
It really is a masterpiece of staging.
Imagine a split-screen effect in a movie showing two entirely different worlds existing in the same physical space.
The juxtaposition here is masterful. It perfectly highlights exactly what is being lost and, to a certain extent, exactly why it deserves to be lost.
On one side of the estate, down by the outer walls, you have Bao Yang.
Right, Bao Yang.
He is a guard, but he's been demoted and practically ignored by the family management.
He wasn't given any official duties for this funeral.
So he's just out by the gate, bored, practicing his martial arts alone in the dark with a wooden club.
He's tough, he's capable, but he has been completely marginalized by the system.
Bao Yang is such a fascinating figure to me.
He represents the raw physical strength the family possesses, but actively refuses to utilize.
Because he doesn't fit into their refined, polite, aristocratic aesthetic, right?
Exactly. He is too coarse for them, so they tuck him away by the gate and forget about him.
Right. And then on the absolute other end of the spectrum, deep inside the luxurious inner compound, you have the nun, Niaoyu.
Ah, Niaoyu.
She is visiting the terrified young girl, Shichun, who is left behind to guard the house.
And what are these two doing while the massive house is practically empty and vulnerable?
They are drinking incredibly rare, specialty rainwater tea and playing chess late into the night.
It is the absolute pinnacle of aristocratic refinement.
To fully grasp the absurdity of this, you have to understand what rainwater tea signifies in this context.
Niaoyu is a character obsessed with purity. She violently despises anything dirty, common, or earthly.
So the tea she serves isn't just made with regular water, is it?
No, it's made from snow or rain, specifically harvested from the blossoms of plum trees years prior.
Harvested from blossoms?
Yes, sealed in jars and buried underground to age.
That is just insane. It requires an obscene amount of wealth, labor, and idle time to produce.
She and Shichun have retreated into this hyper-refined, completely artificial bubble of culture and intellect.
They are completely ignoring the physical reality of the massive, empty, vulnerable house around them.
So you have the ultimate cinematic split screen.
On the left, a tranquil, almost ridiculously refined game of chess with vintage snow water tea.
And on the right, a brutal, violent home invasion is kicking off.
Because suddenly the thieves scale the walls and break into the matriarch's suite.
They smash the heavy locks, they tear open the chests, and they start emptying the family's literal treasury of gold and silver.
The noise of the breaking locks wakes the estate.
And the aesthetic bubble bursts violently.
The brutal physical reality of the outside world crashes right through the delicate paper doors of their sanctuary.
The thieves realize they've been heard, so they grab what they can and flee up onto the roof and into the sprawling gardens.
And the servants who are actually supposed to be on the night watch, the ones being paid to protect the family, what are they doing?
They are absolutely terrified. They are cowering, hiding in corners, completely useless.
And who is the only person in this entire massive compound who actually steps up to fight?
Bao Yang, the demoted, ignored guard with the wooden club.
The profound irony of this moment cannot be overstated.
The family systematically alienated, demeaned, and sidelined their most capable defender.
Yet when the ultimate crisis arrives, he is the only individual who actually performs his duty.
It's incredible.
I have to ask, why is he the only one? Where is the actual official security force?
Well, you'd think a family this wealthy would have dozens of guards, right?
Exactly. Living in a compound this size, they must have hundreds of guards on the payroll.
They absolutely do. But those guards are products of the same corrupt system as the rest of the household.
Right. They have been trained by the environment.
They are used to bullying the weak, taking bribes from servants, and performing their duties only when a master is directly observing them.
So when faced with actual violent danger from desperate armed men, their courage just evaporates.
They have no genuine loyalty to the family, only to their paychecks, and no paycheck is worth dying for.
Bao Yang, interestingly, doesn't fight out of a deep, sycophantic loyalty to the current masters who mistreated him, does he?
No, he fights out of a sense of personal duty and a strict warrior ethos.
He is a moral anomaly in a system built entirely on cowardice and self-preservation.
He immediately goes to work. He spots the thieves, leaps up onto the roof, strikes one down instantly with his club.
And then proceeds to fight off a whole group of them in the garden while the other servants literally tremble in the dark.
It's an incredible visceral action sequence.
But there's a moment during this chaos that is deeply unsettling and shifts the tone from a heist to something much darker.
Yes, when the thieves are running through the compound, they actually pause outside Shi Qin's room.
And they look in and they see the nun, Miao Yu.
They see her illuminated by the lamplight. And the text specifically notes that they are struck by her extraordinary beauty.
They stop running and they leer at her. Their minds immediately jump from robbery to sexual violence.
It is only the sound of Bao Yang relentlessly pursuing them that forces them to abandon the thought and keep running.
It is a terrifying, breathless moment. It just completely shatters the illusion of their safety.
It's the ultimate violation of Niao Yu's extreme, lifelong obsession with purity.
Because she has spent her entire life trying to separate herself from the dirt of the world, physically, emotionally, and spiritually.
But in that terrifying moment, the text brutally reminds us that aesthetic purity offers absolutely zero protection against physical violence.
Without the stone walls, without the guards.
Without coarse, violent men like Bao Yang, whom she would likely despise as dirty and unrefined.
Her delicate refinement makes her nothing but a target.
It exposes the extreme vulnerability and hypocrisy of their isolated, privileged existence.
Their poetry and their rainwater tea require the violence of men like Bao Yang to exist safely.
It's a harsh reality check.
So the adrenaline of the fight eventually fades, the surviving thieves escape over the walls into the night, and the immediate aftermath begins.
This is where the bureaucratic nightmare starts.
Jia Yin and the steward, Lin Zixiao, finally arrive on the scene after the danger has passed.
They survey the damage, the broken locks, the empty treasure chests.
And they go out into the garden and find the thief that Bao Yang struck down.
He's dead.
And when they hold up a lantern and look closely at his face, they realize it's He San.
The disgruntled insider.
The chickens have formally come home to roost.
The internal abuse, the callous firing of an employee, directly created the external threat that breached their walls.
Now, you would think that discovering a massive heist, a breached compound, and a dead body would prompt a massive, overwhelming, coordinated response from the authorities.
You would think so. But the estate guards, who did absolutely nothing during the actual fight, suddenly realize they need to control the narrative.
They tell the local camp officer who arrives to investigate that they were attacked by massive, overwhelming forces of robbers and bandits.
They are clearly trying to cover up their own paralyzing cowardice by exaggerating the scale of the threat.
Which is a standard bureaucratic survival tactic, both then and now.
If the enemy was an unstoppable military-level army, then the guards can't possibly be blamed for failing to stop them.
But the camp officer's response to this claim is absolutely infuriating.
He coldly dismisses their story entirely.
He looks at the crime scene and argues a legal technicality.
He says, because the intruders didn't arrive carrying torches and brandishing weapons initially.
Because they snuck in quietly over the wall first and only used violence when confronted.
It is legally classified as just a theft, not a major bandit attack.
He tells them it's not his jurisdiction to launch a military-style response or a manhunt.
They just need to file a list of missing items with the local magistrate.
This interaction is the final devastating layer of the system's collapse.
We have moved from the failure of the family to the failure of the security to the failure of the state.
I have to express my outrage here on behalf of the writer. The camp officer basically looks at a dead body and an empty vault and says, "You didn't see torches when they first climbed the wall, so it's not my problem."
It's incredibly frustrating to read.
I need you to explain this to me. Is he just incredibly lazy? Is he corrupt and paid off by the thieves? Or is this a deliberate commentary by the author on the total systemic uselessness of the authorities?
It is absolutely a deliberate commentary on institutional decay. And it relies on a very specific understanding of Qing Dynasty law.
Okay, tell me about the law.
In the legal code of the time, there was a massive distinction between banditry and theft.
Banditry versus theft. Okay.
Banditry was a capital offense that required a massive military response. And crucially, if banditry occurred in a magistrate's district, it was a black mark on that official's record.
It meant they had failed to keep the emperor's peace.
Exactly. Which could cost them their job or even their life. Theft, however, was just a localized nuisance.
Ah, so the camp officer is manipulating the crime scene data to protect his own boss's career.
That is exactly what he's doing.
It's like a modern police chief reclassifying a homicide as a suspicious death to keep the city's murder rate looking good for the mayor.
That is a perfect parallel. The officer is splitting hairs over legal definitions, specifically to avoid doing actual dangerous police work.
And to protect the bureaucratic hierarchy, he doesn't want to chase armed men into the dark.
And he doesn't want to report a bandit attack to his superiors. It's infinitely easier to hand the victim some paperwork, tell them to file an itemized list, and walk away.
It's maddening. The system is designed entirely to protect itself from work and accountability, not to protect the citizens it governs.
Exactly. When a society is in late stage decline, its institutions shift their focus from the execution of justice to the mere administration of rules.
The Jia family, who just a generation ago could have commanded armies with a single whispered word,
is now reduced to filling out a lost property form, while the criminals who robbed them walk free in the capital.
Their privilege, which they thought was an invisible shield, has completely evaporated in the face of bureaucratic apathy.
And the final scene of this sequence just violently twists the knife.
Oh, Qifeng, the manager who we remember was coughing up blood and fainting at the very beginning.
She finally drags herself out of bed and arrives at the scene of the crime.
She sees the smashed locks. She sees the empty chests. She knows the wealth is gone. She knows the family's security is a joke. And she knows the authorities are going to do nothing.
She is furious. But she is also, for the first time in her life, completely powerless to catch the real thieves or to fix the overarching decay of her family.
So what does she do? She lashes out at the only people she still has power over.
She demands that the terrified, low-level night watch women, the older servants who cowered during the attack, be tied up and brutally interrogated.